We'll pick up the countdown shortly here in H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
cut,
0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
All right. It seems like things are working again, whatever didn't work the last weekend. So the first thing I have to say is a big thank you to Adam D. for your generous support, and your copy of Lunarcy is in the post. I'll send you the tracking number after the show. If you, too, are interested in receiving your own screener DVD copy of Lunarcy, the 2011 Canadian documentary in which I appeared, you're certainly welcome to one. I will send one pretty much to any U.S. address, and I have a few that I can send to European addresses, basically anywhere that it can be mailed easily from within Germany without filling out a customs form, which I think is pretty much the whole EU. It's an interesting movie, less for me, I would say, than for other people in it, such as the great... I have to now say late, great Alan Bean, who went from being an astronaut, fourth man to walk on the moon, commander of the second mission to Skylab, to being a painter. Fascinating guy. And I got to meet him and talk with him. And in the process verified something which I thought was true, but which I really had to get from the source. Now, the thing being that Skylab is, to date, the only space platform that we humans have put into orbit, where you don't have to touch the sides, essentially. It had a big, clear space in the center, so you could just hang out in weightlessness. Very large volumetrically. The International Space Station contains more total volume, but it's all in these small modules that were designed to fit in the space shuttle payload bay, mostly. But I asked him, because, of course, both on the lunar surface and on Skylab, he'd actually done useful work. That if you've ever looked at the photographs or read the descriptions, Apollo 12, they went and they retrieved portions of a Surveyor spacecraft. They actually landed on the lunar surface, not far from a probe that had touched down about 2 years previously, and had not been transmitting radio signals. They did it all by dead reckoning, essentially, which is very impressive. It proves, right? It proves the feasibility of lunar surface rendezvous even with an unresponsive partner, which is essentially the one thing that has to be proved for a lunar base or settlement, lunar surface establishment of any kind. And they proved it. So there. Anyway, they dismounted parts of it and took them back to Earth for examination. And of course, on Skylab, they had to do all kinds of things, starting with repairs to the orbital workshop itself, which was damaged during launch, of course. And what Alan Bean confirmed for me is what I had suspected, but again, he was the only person then alive who could have said, because Pete Conrad, who was the commander on Apollo 12, and who was the commander of the first manned mission to Skylab, had gone and got himself killed in a motorcycle accident back in 99, which surprised exactly nobody who knew him. That was just the kind of guy he was. Anyhow, he told me, in so many words, that everything they had to do on the Skylab would have been a dozen times easier on the lunar surface. That having a fixed up and down and some kind of surface to bear against really does buy you a lot. And that's been a key element of my approach toward lunar settlement. Now, I believe in the O'Neill concept, that there are so many things which can be done better and more easily in weightlessness, thing being, we don't yet know how necessarily to do those things. That's the key. That in, you know, over 50 years, practically 60 years of human spaceflight, 50 years of long-duration missions, space station and lunar surface missions, we've only learned kind of a little bit so far about how to work in weightlessness. So, for our first big jobs, I really do think we need to go to a planetary surface where there's some good gravity. And the only one that's conveniently close and easy to get away from again is our little companion planet. Anyhow, I'm back in the United States again after a stay of 6 weeks in Germany. And on the Sunday, this past Sunday, not even a week ago, October 3rd, I had an amazing experience there in Germany. Yes, in Munich area, at the northernmost subway station in the Munich system, which is Garching-Forschungszentrum. It ought to be Kernforschungszentrum, Nuclear Research Center, but you don't dare say that in Germany. You go up to the top of the escalator or the stairs of the subway station and you look at the directory. You will not find anything labeled nuclear reactor. You have to look for the thing labeled Neutronenquelle, neutron source. But many institutions, scientific and technical institutions across Germany, on the first Sunday in October every year have an open day, and this has been arranged for years as a result of a children's television program. It's got a name, Zaggeschichten or something, but everyone just calls it the program with the mouse, Die Sendung mit der Maus. That's all anybody calls it. And so they arrange on the first Sunday in October of every year for all kinds of things to be open, and there's special programming for kids. Well, at least at Garching, there was also special programming for adults. I had been trying to find out details about their open day and not succeeding, but I went up there. And I talked to the experimenters who were showing off their experiments. I looked at the wonderful exhibits that they had. I lifted as much in the way of souvenirs as I could make away with without drawing suspicion. I got two tote bags, and I took three copies of each of the kinds of stickers that they had, and two copies of each of the kinds of brochures they had in English, because they mostly had them in German and English, because I have a friend who I think would enjoy some of this stuff, and I'm going to send it to her. Well, when I got there, I discovered that they were signing up people on site for tours of the neutron source, the reactor, that is to say. The FRM2, it's referred to as Forschungsreaktor München number 2. The original Forschungsreaktor München was a 1,000 kilowatt thermal output, 1 megawatt thermal, American machine and foundry swimming pool type reactor that was erected in the course of 11 months in 1957-58, in an aluminum dome that's 30 meters in diameter and 30 meters high. You can't find it very easily now, simply because all the stuff which has been built up around it. I was talking to someone who told me the reason it was put out there in the first place, they were looking for some place with cheap land that was reasonably accessible, and so Garching was known for the extraordinarily poor quality of its potatoes, so they purchased a potato field and built a nuclear research reactor there. Similar logic, as I found out by reading a book in the Bavarian State Library, applies to the location of Kernkraftwerk Isar, the nuclear power plant, roughly at Niedereichbach on the Isar, a little outside of Landshut. Apparently the agricultural land there was poor enough that they figured nobody would miss it. Anyhow, the old American Machine and Foundry building, the reactors was demolished, decommissioned about 1995 or so, and they replaced it with a new reactor, which is a 20 megawatt thermal output reactor, enclosed in a big concrete building. The old building has historic preservation status, which is nifty. But they're actually using it or preparing to use it because the experimental facilities at FRM2, the Hans Meyer Leibniz Center for Neutron Research, are actually way overcrowded. Why are they overcrowded? Well, because it's basically the only nuclear research reactor left in Germany. That the ones at Geesthacht and Jülich, which were about the same age as FRM1, were shut down and nobody made any provisions to replace them. And so all the instruments and experiments that were to have been used there or were being used there basically just got moved to Munich. They designed the thing for about 5 instruments, and they're hosting 31. Anyway, I signed up for the last English language tour of the day, and, well, nobody else showed up for it. None of the other people who signed up showed up. I don't know why not. So as a result, it was just me and a befuddled-looking security guard, and one of the scientists who works there, Dr. Vladimir Hutanu. Voluble fellow. If you've ever gotten a scientist talking about what he does, you know that they love to talk about what they do. And so I think I got a tour that was about twice as long as the others, because they had to have a, you know, audio guide and whatever for the group tours. But I just got talked through it. Anyhow, I did have to wear a dosimeter. We did not go into the reactor hall itself, but we went into both experimental halls. I did have to wear a dosimeter. I was sad I hadn't brought my own. I actually have a quartz fiber electroscope dosimeter, which was given me by a friend, and more importantly, the charging mechanism, charging and reading mechanism for it. And I keep thinking I should be carrying that with me when I travel internationally, just so that I can read the cosmic ray dose I get in the airplane. Anyway, it would have been a grand fun to say, oh, dosimeter, I've got mine right here. I also have an electronic dosimeter, not like the one they gave me, which is all, you know, nifty plastic with an LCD display and all that. No, this is an aluminum box with a rollover display like an old odometer.
I've got to check the circuitry and make sure it works. Anyway, FRM2 is an impressive installation. So yes, I had to wear the radiation measuring instrument to make sure I didn't get overexposed. And then when I left the first experimental hall, I actually had to put my hands and feet in the hand and foot contamination monitor to make sure I hadn't picked up anything I shouldn't have. Which, of course, I didn't. I'm very good about radiation hygiene. And frankly, the reactor wasn't running at the time anyway, so it's less likely that I would have got exposed to anything. But it's a very impressive setup. The reactor uses only a single fuel assembly, which contains 8 kilograms of 93%, that's bomb-grade, uranium-235. 8 kilograms of uranium-235, 93% enriched material. And that fuel element lasts them for 60 days. They do 4 runs in a typical year. So they do 240 working days in a typical year. And it runs around the clock for that 60 days. And then when at the end of 60 days, the fuel element is considered to be burned up and it's moved to the storage pool. Now, a note about that. They only use up about 20% of the atoms of uranium-235. So what's left is still about 6.5 kilograms of uranium-235. And I'll tell you right now, the people who manufacture those fuel elements in France would dearly love to buy back those spent fuel elements and recycle the stuff. But German law doesn't allow that. No, a provision of the 2000 law that was passed by the coalition government of the SPD and the Greens is that not only is reprocessing nuclear fuel in Germany forbidden, but exporting spent nuclear fuel for reprocessing is also forbidden. This is a strategy that the anti-nuclear people have used for years. They call it constipation. Well, the result of that, they've got 50 spaces in their spent fuel pool, and they're almost full now. They've got to find some way to move the stuff off-site. So that's somewhere above 300 kilograms of fully enriched uranium just sitting there. Again, as I say, the people who sold it to them would dearly love to buy it back because there aren't very many sources for highly enriched uranium in the world. You might be able to get it from Russia. You might conceivably be able to get it from China. The United States doesn't produce it anymore, but has a certain stock. But those 300 kilograms, 300 plus kilograms, is a very valuable asset. And so to say you've got to bury it in the ground is sheer madness from my point of view. Now, the reactor is a very interesting design. It's cooled by light water, ordinary water, which passes through the center. And then the fuel element is then immersed in a tank of heavy water. And then around the tank of heavy water is an open pool of light water. And if the cooling pumps were to fail, the light water in the pool would circulate by natural convection through the fuel element. Anyway, so the neutron sources essentially are simply tubes which go through the reactor shield into the heavy water and end. They just end. And the neutrons, which are escape from the fuel element and are slowed down in the heavy water and then return to the fuel element to cause more fissions, well, some of them, they're just wandering around. They encounter a blank space, and by ordinary laws of diffusion, they flow out in the direction. So they have a neutron flow out of each of these tubes that penetrates the shield. They also have the cold neutron source. Now, standard what's called thermal energy for neutrons. Most reactors are what's called thermal reactors. What that means is that the speed of the neutrons is comparable to the speed of a hydrogen atom, which has the same mass as a neutron, roughly, moving in thermal motion. And that's several thousand meters per second, but it works out to an energy of 0.025 electron volt, 1/140th of an electron volt. Now, that's the standard thermal energy, and that's the energy of most of the beam tubes. But they also have a cold neutron source, which is a dewar of liquid deuterium immersed in the moderator tank. And that produces a beam with milli-electron volt energy. And then they have a hot neutron source, which is just a block of graphite, which is heated to 2,000 degrees centigrade. Again, it's insulated and immersed in the moderator tank. The gamma rays heat it to 2,000 degrees centigrade, and so the neutrons which enter that block are actually reheated. There's also a fission neutron source. The fission neutron source is a highly enriched uranium target. Thermal neutrons meet it, cause fissions. The fission neutrons shoot out, some of them, through the beam tube, and the others make their way into the moderator. When I was there, although as I say, the reactor was not active, the fission neutron source was set up to irradiate human beings. Now, does that not sound like mad science? As it turns out, this has to do with experimental cancer therapy. There have been experiments of this kind going on since the 1950s. They started at Brookhaven National Laboratory on Long Island, and they've had a few successes over the years, and they keep plugging away at it. But there's so many fascinating scientific instruments around this neutron source. There's the positron source. They've figured out a way to use neutrons to produce positrons, anti-electrons, and then those anti-electrons are used in various instruments. What's hilarious is they're traveling through evacuated tubes, which are wrapped with copper wire to provide a magnetic field, but they look for all the world like vacuum cleaner hoses or something. It looks like, okay, pull over the hose there and plug it into my spaceship and just fill me up with antimatter. Yep. They've got all kinds of interesting experiments. The scanning positron microscope. You've heard of scanning electron microscopes. This is a scanning positron microscope. Now, why in the world would you want such a thing as that? As it turns out, it's really useful for finding surface defects in semiconductor crystal structures. All right. Other things they do there. Neutron activation analysis. That's a very standard one, where you bombard a sample of something with neutrons. It gives up gamma rays. Those gamma rays have a characteristic spectral fingerprint. You can figure out what is in the material. So, a while back, somebody came up with what they said was an amazing Celtic gold artifact. The government of the state of Bavaria bought it for 5 million euros for one of their museums. And then somebody thought to send it to the lab for authentication, only after they'd written the check. Bad move. The guys at the neutron activation analysis lab said, reads as 9999 fine gold. Did you get a bargain? 9999. That purity of gold has only been possible to obtain since the 1950s. The Celts of 2,000 years ago could maybe get 975 or 980 parts in 1,000. They certainly couldn't get pure gold, that kind of purity. Other instruments. Man, I'm still hung up on that scanning positron microscope. It's got to be the craziest thing. But yeah, other instruments. They've got things that are even weirder than the scanning positron microscope. I mean, the very standard stuff is crystallography, right? If you know anything about the subject, you know that for identifying minerals and understanding their crystal structures and so on, that X-ray crystallography is used because X-rays are diffracted from atoms. There's only one problem. X-ray diffraction doesn't work very well on anything lighter than about silicon or aluminium. It doesn't work very well at all with oxygen, lithium, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen. There are a lot of structures we would like to understand better that use those light elements. Well, neutrons are diffracted very efficiently from those light elements. So you can study crystallography of, oh, you can study what goes on inside lithium batteries. There was a group, I just happened to walk by their workbench, doing protein crystallography, using neutron diffraction to study the properties of proteins. And you had the groups that were using these ultra-cold neutron beams from the cold neutron source. That side of the hall, that's the second experimental hall. They all depend on that cold neutron source, and it is so crowded, the health and safety inspectors must never go in there, because it's just so crowded that if you tripped over anything, you'd break about five legs, your own and four other people's. But that's why they're expanding into the FRM1 building, just to have more space for those experiments. But the crazy thing is that the wavelength, the de Broglie wavelength, of those ultra-cold neutrons is so long that you can do neutron optics. You can actually build up a tube which has got multiple layered coatings and do total internal reflection, which is what, of course, fiber optics works on. But in this case, it's a tube half a meter in diameter or so with several centimeters thickness of multi-layer coatings, and literally the neutrons are guided down the tube. So you can bend the tube around and direct the neutrons wherever you want them to go. And beyond that, you put a strong magnetic field in here, and they have these big superconducting magnets. Well, neutrons have no net electrical charge, but they do have a magnetic moment. The result is you can produce polarized neutron beams. So that was really, as I say, it was an amazing, amazing thing. Let's see, what else do they do at FRM2? Well, they also have a commercial products operation. It's the charter of the research reactor is for scientific research. So they don't do anything that interferes with that. But
there have spaces in the reactor pool where they can put in ingots of silicon. Why, you may ask? Well, as it turns out, the best way to get N-type silicon is by nuclear transmutation. You take those ingots of semiconductor-quality silicon, and you put them into the neutron flux, and a very small fraction, of the silicon atoms, they absorb a neutron and are transmuted into phosphorus. Now, this does something amazing. This gives you excess negative charge carriers in the silicon, which is necessary for making semiconductors. In the normal process, you take the silicon ingot, the boule, and slice it very thinly, and then you put that into a furnace with phosphine gas, and you heat it, and you let the phosphorus dissolve into the silicon wafers, and you get very uneven diffusion, so that you can only predict the characteristics of one transistor within, say, plus or minus 50% compared to its next-door neighbor, even though they're only microns in size.
Well, for high-power switching circuitry, this just won't do. And so they use semiconductor silicon, which is doped by the neutron method. And these high-power switching circuits, thyristors, triacs, and so on, these are necessary for things like grid tie inverters for photovoltaic systems or wind systems, the motor controllers for electric cars. So I find it perfectly funny that all the people who say, well, we don't need nuclear because we've got wind and solar. Turns out your wind and solar won't work without nuclear. How do you like that? Something interesting in that.
What else do I know? What else can I say about it? Well, the other thing that they do make there is medical isotopes, and I sat in on a lecture about medical isotope production. They're very proud of their carrier-free process for producing lutetium-177. They're tooling up to also produce technetium-99, well, molybdenum-99, which is the precursor for technetium-99, but that'll be a few years yet. But lutetium-177 is used in diagnostic imaging and cancer therapy. I kid you not. On the way back from Frankfurt, because I flew out of Frankfurt Airport, God help me, don't do it if you can avoid it, it's awful. Anyway, landed at DFW, went down to get my bags. The guy next to me was talking on his phone about how he hadn't set off the Geiger counters. I got to talking to him. Turned out that he had been in Germany to receive lutetium-177 therapy for cancer, which was approved for general use in Germany in 2014, has not been approved yet for general use in the United States. Our scientists know how to do it, it just hasn't been approved for general use. Anyway, he said that passing through customs on the U.S. side, he'd set off a bunch of radiation detectors, and finally the lady had steered him to one desk where there wasn't one so that he could pass through without being stopped. How do you like that?
So I told him about the open day at the reactor, and he was a little mad because he said he could have actually gone there because that was a day he didn't have anything else to do. That he would have liked to actually see the place where they make the stuff that was being used for his cancer treatment. Now, as there's some chat and com about the audio quality here, and I don't know what's going on, simply because this is a different microphone than I was using previously. This is the one I'm using at home, as opposed to the one I was using in Munich. I think the connection quality is bopping back and forth or something. I don't actually know. Whatever you're experiencing, I don't know what the reason is, and I'm sorry for that. Anyway, I'm just going to mention that if you too, like Adam D. and others I could mention with honor, would like to show your appreciation for these broadcasts, show your support, you can always send me a postal order to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America, and just send me your postcards of comments. Send those letters and postcards. Let me find out what you think, if you're not, you know, chatting in comm, which I glance at occasionally. There's also paypal.me/prometheuslives if you want to go that direction. Anyway, and other than that, up in about 10 seconds is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which airs every day at 1930 UTC on a non-radio.net, a service...